Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How can we learn about how the brain functions by studying the many ways it can malfunction? Although scientific knowledge about the brain has come a long way in recent decades, there's much more we don't know yet about this remarkably complex organ. And the study of damaged brains remains one of the best ways we have to gain new knowledge about how healthy ones are supposed to work. Author Sam Keen explains how this has happened over the centuries in his new book, The Tale of the Dueling Neurosurgeons, The History of the Human Brain as Revealed by True Stories of Trauma, Madness, and Recovery. Sam, welcome back to Think.
Hi, thanks for having me back.
You open the book with a description of a condition you have called sleep paralysis. Mm-hmm. Explain, first of all, what this feels like.
So it's sort of the opposite of sleepwalking. When you're sleepwalking, your body's awake, but your mind isn't. When you have sleep paralysis, your mind is awake, but your body isn't. So you wake up, but you can't open your eyes. You can't move a pinky even. You can't twiddle your toes. You can't do anything, but you are awake. So you're aware of the world going on around you, even though you can't move. And it's really an uncomfortable position to be in because, you know, you feel like you're a statue, like you're paralyzed or something like that. And it's actually not that uncommon. A lot of people do experience sleep paralysis, you know, once or twice in their lives. But some of us, unfortunately, experience it regularly, especially when we fall asleep on our back. So that is how I open up the book, with this sort of unusual brain condition called sleep paralysis.
And I guess experiencing that on multiple occasions would cause you to think a lot about the ways that the brain works and the strange things that can happen when just a little thing is off.
Yeah, so basically what happens is when you dream at night, your brain temporarily paralyzes your body. So, you know, if a werewolf jumps out at you, you're not actually running around the room or taking swings at people, things like that.
Which is a safety measure in
it
a
is.
Way.
Yeah, it's
that
it's,
the brain
it's a good thing that this happens.
Right.
With sleep paralysis, though, what basically happens is your brain doesn't stop sending the chemicals that paralyze your body. So you end up temporarily paralyzed, but you're awake at the same time. And it is a good entree into kind of how the brain works, how sleep works, how dreams work, how they interact, how different systems in the brain are supposed to communicate, and also how they fail to communicate sometimes. And I explain a little bit more in the book about how some people, they actually don't stop dreaming even though they're awake at this point. So they're paralyzed, they're awake, and they're still dreaming. It's kind of this odd, unusual state. And some people think that stories of things like alien abductions or ancient stories about, you know, witches coming in, demons, things like that, might have some sort of connection with people just having sleep paralysis on a regular basis.
So another story in the book, the title story, in fact, is rather gruesome but absolutely fascinating. Back in the mid-16th century, King of France, I guess we can call him like an extreme sports enthusiast.
A macho king,
yeah.
Yes.
Tell us about him.
So it was King Henry II of France. You know, he liked hunting, like jousting, these big games like that. And he was in a jousting tournament one day when he got clobbered in the face pretty hard with a lance. He ended up, you know, going down, was probably unconscious for a little bit. And because he was such an important person, they brought in the two best neurosurgeons in Europe to try to save him. So they're kind of the dueling neurosurgeons of the title, since they were kind of rivals. And most of the king's doctors thought that the king would be okay because they looked at his head and he had some surface wounds, but the skull itself seemed to be fine. There wasn't a crack in the skull, you know, nothing obviously broken up there. And the way they reasoned about the brain at the time was kind of the way we think about an egg nowadays, where if the shell isn't cracked, then the yolk must be fine. So if the skull's okay, then hey, the brain must be fine. But these two prominent neurosurgeons realized that no, actually something was probably deeply wrong inside his brain. It was a new and kind of controversial diagnosis at the time, called a concussion. And they realized that actually he was in a lot of grave danger from this massive concussion that he suffered. And I liked it as the title story for a few reasons. First of all, we usually don't think about, you know, neurosurgery going on in the mid-1500s, but these people were actually doing kind of sophisticated procedures back then. So you can kind of see where neuroscience came from, kind of the genesis of the field many hundreds of years ago. The other reason, of course, is that we're still relearning some of these same hard lessons today. You hear about football players suffering concussions, and then they go right back out on the field because they think, well, you know, there's no blood, and I must be okay then. My brain can't be that hurt.
The helmet's not crushed.
Right. There's no dent in the helmet, so my brain must be okay. So again, we're kind of relearning these hard lessons even 450 years later.
I think it's perfectly appropriate that you call them neurosurgeons based on what they were doing at the time. But this was the time also when like one of these guys was like cutting hair part of the time and taking care of patients part of the time.
Right. So at the time, there was a sharp distinction between physicians, doctors, and surgeons, on the other hand. And surgeons cut things. So they cut people's hair. They might shape your wig. And then in the afternoon, they might have to amputate a leg or something like that. We don't think about those things going together today, but at the time, they sort of put them together. And in fact, neurosurgeons were often looked down upon as these sort of butchers. This was in the days before anesthesia, so a lot of people feared them. So it makes sense on some level, but it's just odd to think about nowadays when surgeons are like, you know, the summa of the medical profession, where, you know, 450 years ago, they were seen as like the worst part of it.
One of the things they considered was drilling some holes in Henry's skull to relieve pressure.
Yeah, that's called a trepanation. And it's a procedure that they do today, often to relieve pressure, or, you know, if they need to make a small hole and get at the brain, something like that, they still do it. And one of the things I found interesting about Henry's case is that he actually might have been okay had he been hit harder and cracked his skull. Because sometimes when the skull gets cracked, it gives the brain room to expand into. If there's a blood clot or something there, it can relieve some of the pressure. Henry's skull was intact, and so there was nowhere for the pressure to the pressure couldn't be released, basically, and it ended up crushing parts of his brain.
Autopsies were not a common thing at the time that Henry died. How was it that the Queen consented to allow these guys to look at his brain after he died?
That is kind of a mystery. It was Queen Catherine, her name. She was one of the Medici of Florence. And no one quite knows why she allowed this to happen. In fact, often when they did do autopsies back then, it was on criminals. And you would sentence someone to death and dissection. So it was kind of a way to get some more punishment out of the person after death. So people did not want to be dissected. There was no sense that you would give your body to science to help out, anything like that. So no one quite knows why exactly the Queen allowed them to do an autopsy on Henry. But it had turned out to be very important because not only did they find out that they were right, so they were able to check their assumptions, a good, important part of science. But they were also, you know, this kind of became a new standard because what happens to the king is often the medical standard for other people. So after this, autopsies started to become more common. And that's basically how neuroscience progressed for hundreds and hundreds of years after this.
But of course, there are so many things that can go wrong with the brain that aren't evident to the naked eye, even if one has access to that brain postmortem.
Right. So there's subtle things, smaller things. Yeah, the brain can go wrong in basically an infinite number of ways. And the book is kind of a catalog of some of the most interesting cases and what we can learn about basically every region of the brain based on what goes wrong.
So many of us imagine that it would be wonderful to have a photographic memory and to forget nothing that we had experienced. And it turns out this is such a terrible curse for the few people that have experienced this.
Yeah, it's a rare condition where basically people cannot forget things. And in the book, I talk about how we sometimes joke as joke about memory as a sieve, like a colander, like things falling through it. That seems like a bad memory. But actually, that's the way all of our memories work. And it's a good thing that they do work that way. The case I talk about in particular is a man named Solomon Sharashevsky. He was a reporter in Moscow, got started in the 1920s, and he was sort of famous for never taking notes during interviews. He would just remember everything that everyone said to him. And it turns out he wasn't actually a very good reporter. he just wasn't, very curious. He wasn't just good, like, hunting down stories. He just had this phenomenal memory. And eventually, he sort of got on this neurological freak show and started traveling around the country. And people would just yell out lists of 50 or 70 numbers to him. And then, he would recite them back to these people. There were other cases where people, read a poem to him in a language he didn't understand. And then 15 years later, he was still able to recite the poem without having practiced in between. So again, this sounds like an amazing talent. Like, oh my God, I wish that we could do this. But it turns out that it was a bit of a curse because basically everything that someone said to him would remind him of 7,000 other things. And whenever he would walk around, there were constantly other memories kind of crowded around in his brain. And he ended up kind of this befuddled and timid man who couldn't quite make his way in the world because it was just sensory overload all the time. Everything reminded him of everything else that had ever happened to him.
When we go back through history and we think about presidential assassins, of course, these seem like some of the worst criminals there could be, and they create all kinds of chaos. And I don't think you're necessarily arguing against that. And yet, it's pretty clear that at least some of the individuals who have taken the lives of prominent people have been very troubled themselves.
Yeah, the most obvious example is Charles Guiteau, who is the man who shot James Garfield. It's pretty clear in retrospect that Guiteau had schizophrenia. Just by his behaviors, his actions, he was deluded. He thought God was directing him to assassinate the president. He was standing up during the trial, singing songs, comparing himself to Napoleon and Cicero. It was very clear something was wrong. But at the time, people were so angered at the fact that he'd killed the president, that they basically kind of railroaded him into a conviction. And I talk about the case in the book because he was one of the first prominent cases where they were trying to figure out insanity and whether, what insanity meant and whether people really deserved punishment if they committed a crime under insanity. And the especially important part of this case was that when they looked at his brain afterward, from sort of a gross overall perspective, his brain looked pretty normal. They couldn't see anything specifically wrong with it. And that shook a lot of people because the theory at the time was, if you're crazy, then there has to be something clearly wrong with your brain. It was only when they really looked at his cells, at the brain on a microscopic level, that they were able to see, oh, actually, there are a lot of malformities. There's a lot wrong when we look at this different scale. So it kind of introduced the idea that the brain works on different levels. And even though things might be okay on a big level, when you look at a smaller level, maybe there is something there. Maybe there's damage to the neurons or the neurochemicals that are in our brain, things like that.
And I suppose the existence of things like neurons and neurochemicals came as a bit of a surprise discovery as they became apparent to people, right? The understanding that the brain is a series of different structures that interact.
Yeah. So again, you got to think about the brain on a lot of different levels. For a long time in the 1800s, people thought about the brain as one sort of gigantic cell, like everything was all working together. They called it was like a giant kind of hairnet in your head, but like a 3D hairnet where everything was connected, very intricate structure. And it was only in the years right after Guiteau, in fact, that they figured out that, no, there are actually lots of separate cells called neurons, and they act, they kind of process information. It's not the best metaphor, but they're kind of like little computer chips where they're just processing information, evaluating things that are going on in your mind, and then making decisions based on that. So it really comes from this era when they were talking about this horrific assassination of a president.
We're speaking this hour with author Sam Keen. He was in town over the weekend for the Mayborn Literary Conference. His new book is called The Tale of the Dueling Neurosurgeons, The History of the Human Brain as Revealed by True Stories of Trauma, Madness, and Recovery. You can join our conversation at 1-800-933-5372. Email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with author Sam Keen about his new book, The Tale of the Dueling Neurosurgeons, The History of the Human Brain as Revealed by True Stories of Trauma, Madness, and Recovery. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. I want to talk a little bit about this idea of recovery, because it seems that brain plasticity is something that we believe in more today than maybe we did in the past. But it turns out in many cases, brains that have suffered pretty serious damage can find ways to reorganize.
Yeah. So for a long time, the scientific dogma was if you lost an ability, the ability to walk or language or memory, if that didn't recover pretty quickly, it was gone and you were not going to be able to recover it. Your brain wouldn't be able to cope. You basically had lost that ability. But more and more, we're finding out that the brain can reorganize. It can either send information through different routes, things like that, or it can come up with coping strategies. One of the probably, I think, most interesting examples is from a few years ago with the Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords. She was shot in the head, and after that, among other things, she lost the ability to speak very well. She had a lot of trouble speaking. But it turns out that there are these back alleys, these back connections in the brain between, say, the language parts of your brain and the musical parts of your brain, and then they can get information from the musical parts of the brain to your mouth. So it's not uncommon to see people who can't speak in everyday conversations, but they can still sing song lyrics. And Gifford could, in fact, do this. She could sing songs like Girls Just Want to Have Fun. And because of this, she was able to relearn how to speak to some degree. So again, it's an amazing example of how the brain can come up with coping strategies and recover some of these lost abilities over time.
I love the story of James Holman, who I suppose he started out being able to see. Tell us his story.
So he was a sailor who was in the British Navy in the early 1800s and loved traveling around, you know, was going up and down the coast of America right after the War of 1812, things like that. But he lost the ability to see. It was sort of an unusual, no one quite knows what happened exactly, but he lost the ability to see. Ended up kind of stuck in England, getting very homesick. He had wanderlust. It was the opposite of homesickness. He wanted to travel all over. And he ended up becoming the most prolific traveler the world had ever known. He traveled something like 250,000 miles, which at the time is mind-boggling. That's like taking a trip to the moon. I mean, that's an amazing distance to cover. And he did it all while he was completely blind. And what he learned to do was he used a cane. And he didn't use it like blind people do today, where they sort of feel their way out. What he would do is he would take the cane, it had a metal tip on it, and he would click it on the ground, and it would create echoes that would bounce, sound waves that would bounce off things and echo into his ear. And from that, he could kind of triangulate where the sound waves were coming from and figure out what the scene in front of him was. So he knew that based on how the sound, the quality of it rebounding, that it was a statue in front of him or a horse, or that there was a doorway there. And he ended up becoming so good at this that he was climbing Mount Vesuvius while it was erupting, even though he was blind. He was traveling around the world looking at great sculptures, art, things like that, hunting down slave traders in the Atlantic Ocean, doing all these really incredible things while completely blind. And the neuroscience comes in because there are actually people who can do this today with clicking, kind of feeling their way around the world through sound. And when they look at their brains in a brain scanner, it turns out that the visual parts of their brain actually light up a lot. There's a lot of activity in the visual parts of the brain, even though they can't see anything. So what seems to have happened is that that part of the brain has been repurposed a little bit, and it's learning how to navigate not through sight, but it's using that empty processing power to figure out how to calculate and process sound waves. So again, an amazing example of the brain taking in information, using it a different way, and coping, finding out how to do the same thing, like navigate the world.
It would seem like Holman didn't have a lot of fear. And again, like being unafraid of everything is another one of these things that I think lots of people dream about. But it can be very, very dangerous.
Yeah, the story in the book I talk about here is a woman named S.M. who was alive. She's alive today. She was growing up in Iowa in the 1960s, known as S.M. in the medical literature. And she basically had damage to her amygdala, which are structures in the limbic system that are especially involved in processing fear. And she basically hasn't, you know, suffered or felt any real fear since she lost her amygdala when she was a little girl. And I think the studies of her, actually, they're kind of a hoot to read about, because basically scientists have to try to think up ever more elaborate ways to frighten her. So they bring her to exotic pet stores with snakes, or they run her through a haunted house, things like that. And the one story I really remember about her being in the haunted house was they put her with these other five people as kind of a control group, and they were walking around and the other people were screaming and ducking their eyes and scared. But this woman, SM, was just running ahead all the time to see what was next. And toward the end of the run through the haunted house, this monster jumped out. And it was an actor in a costume, obviously. But a monster jumped out and roared and waved its arms. And SM didn't blink at it. But she got interested in its mask because it had kind of this bloody goo on it. And she walked up to it and she kind of lunged at the monster to feel its mask. And she ended up scaring the monster because he didn't expect, you know, to be accosted in this underground lair. So basically any test that they could come up with this woman, she was incapable of feeling fear.
What's so strange is to think what it must have, what life must feel like for her, because she can watch a movie and cry at something sad or laugh at something funny. She's not incapable of experiencing any other emotion.
Yeah, it's really fear for some reason that depends heavily on the amygdala, and it's fear that sort of evaporated from her mind. So as you said, she can be happy, she can be sad, disgusted, angry, all of these different things. And as you were saying before, we think that, wow, that sounds like an amazing thing to have no fear. But it turns out that actually she ended up getting herself in danger in certain situations. She's been in domestic abuse situations. There was a time when, if you read about what she did, she basically put herself in a really terrible situation walking through a park at night, seeing this drugged out man off to the side who told her to come over there, and she had no fear of him. So she just walked right over to this man, pulled a knife on her. She could well easily have died in multiple situations because she simply had no fear of whatever was going on around her. It's like when her fear disappeared, she almost kind of lost her common sense, her sense of, I should be afraid of that because I'm going to die.
So the amygdala produces fear. There are other brain structures that affect other emotions. And yet our emotions, the way we perceive them, it seems like they are completely organic and things that make sense. And so what do we do with our idea of who we are once we can break everything down to the function of particular brain structures?
One thing I found really interesting in the book is that, you know, the sense of self is something very important to all of us. We know who we are deep down, and we want to hold on to that. And I think that's why things like amnesia, really profound amnesia, like I talk about in the book with a few cases, that seems really frightening, to lose our memories. We think it's almost losing ourself. But it turns out that the sense of self is actually very hard to dislodge. There are different parts involved with the self. There's memory. There's your sense of, you know, your own personality. There's your relationship with your loved ones. There's lots of different things that contribute to the sense of self. And in pretty much every case I looked at, even though these big things were getting wiped out, like memory, emotion, people still retained a sense of who they were deep down. It's very, very hard to dislodge that. And I think what that says is that your sense of self isn't located in one single part of your brain. There's a lot of different things that do contribute to it, and it's really a matter of all those things working together that gives you a sense of who you are deep down.
How did we start to understand that we store different kinds of memories and knowledge in different ways?
This was a case, a man named H.M., a very famous amnesiac, in Connecticut in the 1950s he was growing up. And he had pretty severe epilepsy. And so the doctor, his doctor came in, tried a kind of radical surgery on him where he removed a structure called the hippocampus on each side of his head. They didn't quite know what the hippocampus did before that. And they found out pretty quickly afterward that the hippocampus is involved with forming and storing memories. So basically after that, he could not form new memories. You could tell him 40 times where the bathroom was and he would not remember any time. He would eat multiple breakfasts in the morning because he forgot he'd had his breakfast already. It's like his appetite had a memory too. But they did find out that there were some things that he could still learn how to do, certain types of memories that he did retain. Specifically, they're called motor memories or muscle memories. So we usually talk about memory as kind of one thing, like a monolithic thing. I remember a name. I remember a date. I remember how I felt when I got that really great Christmas present. I remember how to ride a bike. But memories that involve muscles are actually separate, and they involve different systems in the brain. And it turns out that they were able to teach HM how to do certain motor activities, and he was able to remember how to do those things. He didn't remember any of the training he'd gone through, and there were a couple of these kind of puzzles and things he had to do where he startled himself because he said, wow, you know, I didn't know I'd be so smart and be able to figure out this puzzle so quickly. He'd been practicing for weeks. He just didn't remember that. But it did help neuroscientists kind of tease apart different types of memory systems in the brain. And in fact, since then, with other cases, they've been able to tease out even more types of memory. And we now know that there are, you know, depending on how you want to count, there are probably three major types of memory. There are muscle memories, motor memories. There's memories of semantic things. So basically anything you could look up in an encyclopedia or a dictionary, facts about the world. And then there are personal memories, memories of times you were lonely, times you were happy, what it looked like at your first birthday party that you can remember, all of these different types of things.
So it's possible for people to suffer some kind of brain damage and be able to remember the date that the Revolutionary War started but not remember childhood.
Yeah, exactly. There was where they really figured out to distinguish between personal memories and semantic memories was a man who was working in Canada, especially a famous patient he had named KC. And KC could remember, you know, how to play pool. He knew all the rules of the Price is Right game shows because he loved watching the show. But he could never remember a time he had ever played pool with his friends. Mm-hmm. He could never remember a time he'd actually been watching the Price is Right. So he knew kind of the abstract things about how these games worked, but he didn't have any memories of actually experiencing those things.
I think the thing in your book that I'm going to remember most and think about most as I go into the future is the story of these two little twin girls in mm-hmm. Canada. Tell us about the Hogan sisters, Logan sisters.
So they're conjoined twins, what used to be called Siamese twins, and they're basically conjoined at the head. And specifically, the part of their brain that is connected is a structure called the thalamus. Thalamus is really a relay center inside the brain. So most of your sensory input from your eyes and your ears especially goes into the thalamus. The thalamus says, okay, this is the kind of information we have, and it divides it up and sends some of the information this way, some of the information in another way. So basically, again, a relay center inside your mm-hmm. brain. Because they share a thalamus, and because the thalamus is very involved with sensory input, the girls actually share sensory information. So, for instance, one girl could be taking a sip on her cup of juice, and the other girl can taste the juice in her mouth. If you tickle one of the girls, the other girl will laugh. If you go to the doctor's office and one of them gets a shot, the other one will wince. The story I remember that stands out to me most vividly is someone saw them once in a fast food restaurant. And, you know, they're kids. They're going to get into fights, things like that. They were pushing each other. Finally, one of the sisters got sick of it, and she reached out and she slapped her sister in the face and then reached up and grabbed her own face in pain because mm-hmm. it hurt her to hit her sister like that. And I think the really interesting question about the two girls is, and I should emphasize, you know, they're healthy, they're happy girls, they're doing pretty well. But it's kind of an interesting question about whether they're two individual people or whether they're kind of one person in some sense, because they are sharing sensory information. And in some sense, they're even sharing their consciousness on some level, because they are, you know, sharing thoughts about the world. They're aware of the same things going on around them on some level. And I think most of the evidence points toward them being individual people, based on the things that I was talking about before, about how deep your sense of self is, how instinctive it is for you to kind of define yourself as an individual, as a separate, unique person. So based on the stories about them and their behaviors, I do think they come out as individual people, even though they are sharing their consciousness on some level.
Well, I was struck by the fact that you write about one of them likes creamed corn and the other one hates it. So one of them takes a bite of creamed corn and the other one is like, oh, I can't stand this. They're alike enough and they share enough that they both taste it, but they're different enough individuals that they have their own preferences.
Yeah, so ketchup especially is another thing where one likes it, the other one doesn't. And with corn, it was even worse than that. One girl actually breaks out in hives because she's slightly allergic to corn, where the other one can eat it just fine. So you're right. You're exactly right that they do have distinct preferences, distinct things that they like. So even though on some physiological level they are experiencing the same thing, their response to it is quite different. Just like, you know, you or I, you might hate ketchup, so you take a bite of it and you think, oh God, this is terrible, I don't like this. Whereas I am getting the exact same molecules in my mouth, having a much different experience. The girls have those exact same differences going on inside them. So again, it is, I think, evidence that they are individual people despite sharing parts of their brain.
So is consciousness just an accident of chemistry and electrical pulses, or is it something else?
It's hard to think about consciousness in terms of chemistry and electrical pulses, because that's kind of the wrong level to look at. A good comparison, it's something they call an emergent property. So an example of an emergent property is wetness. So if you were to look at water molecules, individual H2O atoms down there, and even how they interact a little bit, you could learn every single thing about them. But that's not going to tell you anything about what it's like to stick your hand in a pail of ice-cold water. That's a different sensation because it involves billions of billions of billions of water molecules all working together. Consciousness is a lot the same way in that, yes, you can talk about neurochemicals, electrical pulses, things like that. But if you want to get into consciousness, you have to look at the brain as a whole. You have to look on a much bigger scale, and we can't necessarily jump easily from one to the other. We have a lot of work to do yet.
Author Sam Keen is here, fresh from this weekend's Mayborn Literary Conference. His new book is called The Tale of the Dueling Neurosurgeons, The History of the Human Brain as Revealed by True Stories of Trauma, Madness, and Recovery. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. Send email to think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with author Sam Keen. His new book is called The Tale of the Dueling Neurosurgeons, The History of the Human Brain as Revealed by True Stories of Trauma, Madness, and Recovery. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 to ask a question or share a story. You can also send email to think@kera.org. We try to be really careful these days about medical ethics, but it seems that in particular with brain research down through the years, we've done some pretty awful things to people.
Yeah, there are a few cases in the book that are a little uncomfortable to read about. Some of them, the people definitely had good intent. Some of the surgeries that didn't turn out very well, things like that. You can see at least, what they were trying at, and you can sympathize with them somewhat on some level. There was another case in particular, though, that really stood out for me. I could not believe, A, that this happened, and B, that it's not more well known. I've never, I don't think, seen kind of a bigger violation of medical ethics than this case. It was a case involving a man named Roberts Bartholow, who was a doctor in Cincinnati in the early 1870s. And he was very interested in the idea. They'd done some experiments with dogs, things like that, where you could spark part of the brain and their limb would move or they would make a noise. So he was very interested in the idea that you could apply a little electricity to the surface of the brain and then the body would respond in some way. He decided that we needed to test this and confirm this with human beings. And, you know, it was just an idea in his head until this maid came in, a woman named Mary Rafferty, who happened to have a cancerous ulcer in her scalp that basically ate away her skull and scalp and left her brain exposed. And they did try to save her. They gave her the best medical care they could at the time. But when it became clear that she just wasn't going to recover, Bartholow decided he was going to run this experiment on her. And it's pretty clear from the evidence, he even admitted that she was rather feeble-minded, so probably had a mental handicap, but he decided he was going to run these experiments anyway. So he just started sparking different parts of her brain, you know, making her kick out, making her scream, do things like that, and just kept going with this work. And eventually, you know, not long after that, she ended up dying. It's hard to say what exactly killed her, but it was this really awful experiment that you read about. And it does force you to kind of confront the fact that every now and then, you know, most of the scientists were doing good, important ethical work. But every now and then you come across a case like this where it really makes you swallow hard and think about how science works, especially when you're dealing with something like the brain, which is so involved with our memories, our emotions, things that really make us who we are.
And of course, there are even questions about certain kinds of psychological research. You know, you think about the Stanford Prison Experiment, things like that, where people are put in situations that could be traumatic. Should we have questions about what we use when we learn something from science that's done in this way?
I think the time to intercede with these things is before they happen.
Yeah.
Because after they happened, you could look at it either way. You could say, no, we can't look at this information. We can't use it because we're just justifying what this person did. Or you could make the opposite argument, which is that it's already done. We can't right the wrong that we did. And we should try to honor the people who suffered this by at least trying to learn a little bit something about this. So I really think the time to intervene is to get at people or get at scientists beforehand, make sure they understand that knowledge is important, but there are other considerations along the way. You can't just trample people's individual rights in pursuit of something, no matter how important it is.
How did we begin to understand this phenomenon of phantom limb pain?
Phantom limbs, you know, most people have probably heard of it. It's when you lose an arm or a leg or something, but you can still feel it there. You can still, it's sometimes it even hurts. It can cramp up. You can feel shooting pain. And in fact, you can get a phantom for basically any part of your body. People have phantom teeth. Women who have hysterectomies sometimes have phantom labor pains. You can get phantoms anywhere in your body. It's this really incredible aspect of how the brain works. And we really first learned about it during the Civil War because that was the first time when doctors, A, started seeing lots and lots of cases of shattered limbs and started seeing lots of amputations. Basically, they had new types of bullets that shattered bones more effectively during the Civil War. And we also had the ability to save soldiers a little better because it was they were improving patient care. We had anesthetics for the first time, so they were doing more amputations, things like that. So because of that, doctors started to see a large number of phantom limbs for the first time and really figure out how they work. And what they found is that, you know, the body is playing a part of it, but most of it is actually going on inside the brain. It's the brain that's sensing the limb is there, even though it's not. It's the brain that's really causing the pain that they're experiencing. And it's really the brain that's creating these phantoms for people. So again, it was really the Civil War that allowed us to see this for the first time.
And sometimes the brain interferes with how we perceive the people around us. And there is one condition in which people think that familiar figures in their lives, family members, friends, neighbors, are imposters.
Yeah, it's called Capgras syndrome. And it sounds like a purely psychological thing, as if this is someone who maybe, you know, has schizophrenia, something like that. Basically, they think that all of their loved ones have been replaced by imposters. It used to be actors or things like that. Nowadays, it's more androids or clones. So it kind of changes.
Culturally dependent.
Yeah, mm-hmm. As the technology advances. What's interesting, though, is that when you look at these people's brains, they often have damage in a few specific spots. So it's specific organic brain damage that's causing these odd psychological symptoms. So again, you can trace it to something very specific, a very a clear case of damage in the brain. And so from that, you can learn different things about how the brain is organized, how it's put together, and why it's causing people to jump to these very bizarre, very weird conclusions that their loved ones have been replaced by imposters.
And can they get better after this has begun?
Often they do get better. Sometimes people don't, though. Or they show kind of unusual symptoms in that when they're face-to-face with the person, they think it's an imposter. That person could go down the hallway, call them on the telephone. They could just hear the person's voice, and they're like, Dad, oh, it's Dad again. They think it's the person when it's just the voice, but when it's face-to-face, they still think it's an imposter. So again, it has a lot to do with how the brain is organized, how we process information, which information we give more credit to. We apparently give more credit to sight than we do voice, because when you're talking with a person face-to-face, you think it's an imposter. When you isolate the voice, suddenly it feels like the person again.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Karen in Fort Worth. Hi, Karen.
Hi, how are y'all today?
Great, thank you.
I was calling to ask a question that I've had so much curiosity about. I once went to a family gathering and was drinking grape soda, and I walked away and I came back and took a big swig of it, and somebody had had dumped their cigarette ashes in it. And now I can't even smell grape soda or taste it without immediately going to that cigarette ash taste. I was wondering if your guest could explain, if he's done much research into like sensory experiences and how that translates to our memory. I don't know. It's always just perplexed me that I can't even taste a drop of it and automatically cigarette ash, you know.
I know people who have that experience with tequila later on.
Yes, that's probably more common. I do talk a little bit in the brain about how our sensory systems, our sensory input, does tie very closely into our memories. And sometimes you forge new links within the brain. They talk about this in terms of wiring. So apparently in the guest's brain, or in the case of tequila, certain things got wired together. So whenever this, she drinks grape pop and the taste of grape pop comes into her mouth, it's somehow signaling another circuit in her brain that's connected to the taste of cigarette ash. So it's basically the brain, an example of brain plasticity, the brain forming new connections, forming new associations, and linking those two things together that weren't linked before. Sometimes those associations disappear over time, but in this case, they seem to have forged a strong connection and they've lasted.
Is it true that people who suffer brain injury at a young age are in a better position to compensate than people who are much older?
Yeah, definitely. The brain is much more plastic when you're young, and you're able to kind of compensate and maybe get around the problems in some way. There are instances of people with very severe epilepsy when they're young children, 3-4 years old, where basically the epilepsy, the seizures have taken over their life. They can actually remove half of the brain, just take it out completely, and the person will recover and grow up and lead a fairly normal life. You could never do that to an adult. It would just not work. The person would not be able to survive. If they did survive, they would probably be in a vegetative state. So when you're young, you do have a much much greater likelihood of recovering than when you're older.
This leads us sort of to the story of Phineas Gage, who is one of these figures that many people feel we know the story of, but whose real life was quite a bit more nuanced after his accident than we may have heard.
Yes, exactly. exactly. So the story of Phineas Gage was the person, he had a long metal spike, basically, that he was doing some work with explosives, kind of tapping it down. The explosive went off. The metal spike was driven through the top of his head. It blew out the top of his skull and, you know, damaged a large part of his frontal lobe. He survived this miraculously. He said he never even lost consciousness after this went through his brain. And he became a very important case because his personality changed afterward. And the story most people hear is that he went from this virtuous, very good person to becoming sort of this drunken lout or a criminal or some sort of a grifter, a fraudster, something like that. So basically, he went from a very good person to kind of this despicable, low-life drifter. There's actually almost no evidence that he led a terrible life afterward. In fact, there's some evidence that he ended up recovering somewhat, and he was never the same as he was before, but he probably ended up going on to lead kind of a normal life. So again, it's an example of this incredible story of the brain healing itself, recovering, and, you know, if even Phineas Gage could recover, I think that's a powerful message of hope for people.
Why do you think his story was oversimplified?
Because we needed some sort of case to really show that personality was tied up with our brain. So I think what people did is basically exaggerated it. They didn't want to say, well, you know, he changed subtly after this accident. It was a more powerful case if you could say, oh, he changed completely. He was a totally different person afterward, because at the time they were even trying to make the case that the brain was involved with your personality. A lot of people had this sort of ethereal picture of how personality worked. You know, there was a lot of talk of how we all had a soul and that the soul was inside the brain and things like that. But neuroscientists wanted to say, okay, you know, whatever we believe about that, there is something about our brain that does play into our personalities. And by exaggerating the Phineas Gage case, they could make that a more powerful case.
One thing that I'm glad that people are no longer saying is, do you remember when you were a kid and there was the old expression that we only use 10% of our brains?
Yes.
It seems like nobody believes that anymore.
Except that movie is coming out now, I think, where the premise is the woman figures out how to use all 100% of her brain. And she's, you know, bending metal guns and things like that. It's a little ridiculous. But you're right. That is a myth. We use more than 10% of our brain. And we even use more than 10% of our brain at any single moment. So it's a little hard to know where it came from, how it got started. But it is a myth. And we do use a lot of our brain in a lot of situations. It's not just 10%.
Will we continue to need people who have suffered brain injury, brain disease, to understand the function of healthy brains?
Unfortunately, there's certain things that we can only infer by people suffering these kind of injuries. We do have, thankfully, incredible tools, MRI, CAT scans, PET scans, where we can do other things. And we can even, in some cases, induce what's called a virtual lesion. So basically, you're using electromagnetic pulses to temporarily disable a part of the brain. It's fine. It's completely reversible. And you can kind of induce a lesion. But that's hard to do on deeper structures inside the brain. And we still do need these cases, because when you're in a lab just doing an experiment, that's kind of an artificial situation. Mm-hmm. You want to make sure that you're seeing people in daily life, having to do daily things. And it's hard to get that kind of information from just brain scans. So in a lot of cases, we do still rely on these people. These are historical stories in some cases, but they're still very relevant to how we understand the brain today.
The new book by Sam Keen is called The Tale of the Dueling Neurosurgeons, The History of the Human Brain as Revealed by True Stories of Trauma, Madness, and Recovery. Sam, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thanks for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer with help on the phones today from Christina Ulsh. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.